La-di-da-di.
What?
La-di-da-di.
What are you talking about?
La-di-da-di. We like to party. We don't cause trouble. We don't bother nobody. We're just some ladies on the mic. And when we rock up on the mic, we rock the mic. Right?
Oh, my goodness. I just love when you... I love when you Slick Rick it out.
I love me some Slick Rick, 1985.
I gotta say, though, the very first time that you burst out into that rap in front of a group of people, we were all kind of like, wait a minute. Hana, black, hijabi, Muslim woman, getting funky on the mic?
Yeah.
I mean, is that the Muslim way?
That reaction, that's why I want to talk about this today.
Yes.
Why? Like, what does it mean to be a black Muslim woman?
A BMW.
A BMW. Ready for the ride?
Vroom, vroom. Let's go.
The Stoop.
The Stoop.
The Stoop.
The Stoop.
Stories from across the black diaspora
that we need to talk about.
My cousins were water and grease girls, and I couldn't be a water and grease girl.
That's what I'm talking about, ballerina in the hood.
We be Gullah Geechee anointed people.
When a black woman walks up to the desk in labor, what preconceived notions do you have about her?
I didn't even know we had a hair chart.
All right, so Lila, first, I want you to watch something with me.
Okay.
Visibly Muslim, hijabi.
All right, so this is Leah V. She is 40 years old and just fabulous and in this video.
Yeah, she's dancing in the streets, having a good old time.
She's wearing all these different outfits and scarves. She's got this gorgeous makeup on.
I'm fat, but don't get it twisted.
So she's a plus-size model from Detroit, Michigan.
Are you afraid that if we could actually love, really love our true selves, imperfections and all, that we'd be free?
You know, I would not have thought she was a Muslim woman. Just, you would have to tell me that.
Because, why?
Because she doesn't look what I would think is like a traditional image of a Muslim woman. Mm-hmm. That would be you.
Do I make you feel uncomfortable?
She's a writer, and she's an Instagram-verified Instagrammer. I didn't know that was a thing.
A blue checkmark, honey.
Blue checkmark.
Yes.
You know. And she made this video back in 2017.
And it was just basically me in clothing, in a turban, face was beat, tongue pop.
Tongue pop.
Yep. That's her signature. A tongue pop.
And I was dancing in 90-degree weather to this really cool beat, and I just basically made the video because I'm just like, there are a lot of dance videos going around, and there's none that have someone who looks like me dancing. So I was like, I'm going to do it, put it out.
And then the comment section started filling up.
Oh, the comment section.
And the Muslim men and some of the foreign Muslim women, or non-black Muslim women, they were like, oh, I hope Allah breaks your back so that you can't dance ever again. And they just kept coming to, like, my computer. And I'm just like, well, I'm going to turn off the notifications now. So for 48 hours straight, I was, like, spammed and trolled on my Instagram account, on CBS, because that's where it was featured, CBS website, on my blog, on YouTube. Like, they were just so mad that I was just unapologetically fat, black, and Muslim dancing.
Okay, so there's something about living at this intersection, this three-way intersection.
Three-way.
It's being black and being Muslim and being a woman, right? I feel it a lot. Like, you're navigating these three different identities that you have. I mean, each one is beautiful, but each one comes with, like, expectations, right? People are looking at you, oh, you're a woman, oh, you're a Muslim, oh, you're black. Those three things come with a lot. And sometimes when you don't, like, neatly fit into what someone's idea is of, you know, how you should look, how you should be acting, that's when the haters show up. And those haters, a lot of the time, they're from within those identities.
Yeah, so on one side, you're dealing with people who don't know enough about your culture, so they stereotype you in the sense like, ooh, you shouldn't be, I don't know about you saying all the slick Rick, you know, like that's not part of who you are, is
right,
it?
Right.
That's uh-huh. So that's the outside perspective. And then from the inside, you have people actually thinking that maybe you shouldn't be doing that at all.
Yeah. Like it's some kind of misrepresentation.
Right.
Okay, so let me tell you some more about how Leah got to be who she is. She grew up Muslim, so she's not a convert to Islam. She grew up Muslim in the Detroit area, and she's always had this complicated relationship with her community.
And so I think I started wearing hijab. I want to say like maybe I remember wanting to wear it, and it was, I want to say like maybe 8-ish. But I remember, like, my mom taking me to the hair salon to get my hair braided, and they were going to put beads, you know, little black girls in beads. Like, that's our thing. We get to hear them, like, we can shake them around and hear them ching, you know, clink against each other. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to get my hair braided, and all the little girls on my block, I'm going to show them my hair because it's so beautiful. And my mom came in after it was done, paid the lady, and I just was, like, excited, shaking them around. And she passed me my scarf, and I was like, oh, so I have to always wear this.
8 years old and wearing a hijab.
I mean, a lot of people in the Muslim community want to, like, train their girls from a younger age so that it's not all of a sudden something they have to start doing in high school or in college. Mm-hmm. So some people do that. Hey, and that's their thing. That's what they do. But, you know, for Leah, again, the intersections, right? Like, these two parts of her, the black part and the Muslim part, were starting to, like, clash.
Yeah.
It's two parts of her identity, and all of a sudden they were in conflict. And she says she really wrestled with this internally as she was growing up. Then she got to college, and things got even more complicated. Non-black Muslims, so, like, Arab Americans, South Asians, people from Pakistan, all over the Arab world, Iran, they were constantly asking her these questions on campus and at the mosque.
I've had things of like, oh, do you know how to say assalamu alaikum? Do you know about fasting? It's Ramadan, sister. They talk to you as if you are some watered-down version of a Muslim.
Those questions were sometimes followed with other questions about her ethnicity.
You would have people come up to you and ask you, like, oh, are you Muslim? And you're like, and like, I'm such an asshole. I'd be like, what gave it away? And I have like a full ass hijab on. And they'd be like, oh, I'm just asking, sister, like, are you, what part of Africa are you from? And I'm just like, I'm African American. And they're like, oh, no, but what, like, where are your parents from? They're from the South. But no, where's your grandparents from? And like, not only like white people do that to me, but you'll see like Middle Eastern Muslims doing it too, because they want to know like where you're from, because like you can't possibly be a hijabi American, right? Like for you to be like a full-blown authentic Muslim, you have to be from the Middle East.
Can I just take a moment to recognize that she said a full-ass hijab?
Yes.
I like that.
You like that? You would like that, Leah.
I do.
I mean, she's really honest, this girl. She's like, look at me. I'm not taking any, you know?
Right, right. A lot of the time, that condescension, you know, those comments and those things would be tied to, like, what she's wearing, to her style.
I was very much so into, like, Gwen Stefani and Cyndi Lauper and Madonna. So I was, like, the rocker hijabi who is, like, the black nail polish and the black lipstick and the dark eyeshadow and the chunky, like, Spice Girl heels and stuff like that with hijab on. So, like, I was automatically, like, othered from, like, the other Muslims in the community, whether it was, like, the black or the Middle Eastern or whoever it was. But I've had people come up to me and tell me, like, that's not proper hijab, or sister, you're not supposed to have black nail polish on, or like, oh my God, you have red lipstick on, you wear makeup, that's not modesty, that's not hijab.
It was a lot. It was a lot that she was hearing and dealing with. And she heard it all the time. And it was hard. So she just tried to fit in.
So for a long time, I didn't try to stuff myself into a category of the good hijabi, like everybody else. And I think that was, like, I think, the worst time of my life, because to stuff yourself into an identity and a narrative that is not yours is very harmful in the long run. And so when I did break out, I broke out very hard. I was, like, the other end of the spectrum. Like, it was to the point where I'm just like, fuck the hijab.
Goodness gracious. I don't know if I like those words next to each other. Hana, are you having some thoughts about this?
I understand your sentiment about the words.
Well, and I am not a Black Muslim woman.
Right. But I kind of feel what she's talking about.
Yeah, okay.
It's the haram police.
The haram police. What is that?
So the word haram means prohibited in Arabic. And so it's these folks in the community. Every community has them. Those judgmental people, the strict people. Mm-hmm. They feel like they need to be, you know, showing you the right way, how to do stuff. The haram police are people who, like, you know, those guys that are, and women who are, like, wagging their finger at you, you know, don't do this, don't do that. They're, like, calling you out as
conservative.
They're being judgy, and they're calling you out as a sinner.
Okay, but before we keep going with Leah's story, I have to say that policing women's clothing and bodies, I mean, it isn't just a Muslim thing.
Yes.
So it happens to women everywhere.
But what's different here is there may be something else at work. It may not just be about policing women's bodies. It may be a disguise for something else.
What are you talking about?
Racism. So, like, Leela, there's this word I found out about recently, not too long ago. I had not heard it before. Have you heard the word hojabi?
Hojabi.
Hojabi.
I've never heard that.
What does it sound like?
I mean, it's a cross between a ho and a hijabi. Had you heard it? You hadn't heard that before?
I hadn't heard of it before, but yes, you're right. Ding, 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 ding. It is a mix between the word ho and the word hijabi. It's even in the Urban Dictionary. Would you like a definition?
Oh, my gosh. Break down hijabi.
Hijabi. A Muslim girl, in parentheses, wears a hijab or a scarf, who acts like a hoe, because there's a lot of complication with that term.
Okay.
Hijabi, most of the time, if you're going to hear it, is like an intra-community insult. It's a way somebody is going to demean a Muslim woman.
Okay, so that's Vanessa Taylor. She's a writer out of Philadelphia. And I wanted to talk to her because, so back in June of 2018, there was this op-ed in the New York Times, and it was called How to Be a Hijabi in the New York Times. Hmm. The writer was a young Muslim woman. She's a Moroccan American. She wrote about how Muslim women are forced into, like, one of two boxes, one of two tropes, either wives or whores. Mm-hmm. So the writer in the New York Times article wanted to reclaim the word hijabi. But our girl Vanessa, she thought that might not be so easy for everyone.
Mm-hmm. When I have seen Muslim women get attacked, get called hijabi, it's been Black Muslim women overwhelmingly.
Vanessa, she wasn't quiet. Uh-huh. She wrote an article in response to that New York Times article. And she basically said, you can't talk about any of this without talking about Blackness.
So it's the idea that Muslims are, like, simultaneously repressed, perverted, overcompensating, unhinged, all of these things in terms of our sexuality. But when you throw being Black on top of that, especially being a Black woman, you're still getting read through the tropes of being, like, a Jezebel, so somebody who always wants sex, who's always open, willing, and ready, and then cannot be harassed, raped, or a victim of any other type of sexual assault. That's not the case for everybody, because again, Black Muslim women are still being read through the tropes of Black sexuality, where Black womanhood is open and available for everybody's consumption.
It's so interesting, Hana, because it's not something I've ever thought about, which is the fact that being Muslim does not exempt you from these stereotypes of Black women, you know, over-sexualized, images and stereotypes.
Yeah. Yeah. No. So what it leads to then is even deeper levels of policing. So Vanessa recently, like, personally got a taste of this from an Iraqi woman on Twitter. Mm-hmm. The woman was criticizing her profile picture. She has this cute profile picture. And the woman was saying she doesn't look like a hijabi. Mm-hmm. And, quote, hopes Allah assists you with the realization that a bandana doesn't count as a hijab.
A bandana is not a hijab.
She called her out. And Vanessa hit back.
I'm wearing a turban in my Twitter avi, so it's very clearly not a bandana. So I think we can start there with the assumption that hijab is only what non-Black Muslim women say it is.
Okay, but then I asked her, is this really about a bandana?
It disguises itself as being about clothing. But the thing is, Black Muslim women can never really win. Clothing is just an easy excuse.
I think, though, something we haven't talked about is just the way that you can wear a hijab. Like, there's different ways that you can wear it, and there's also, like, a standard, right, that it seems like some sort of very strict conservative people think, like, this is the way that you are supposed to wear your hijab, this is the way you're supposed to dress, and it is all tied together. So when we're talking about, like, a bandana, which I'm thinking just covering the head.
She was wearing, let me show you. How about you see it? Because yeah. What the girl was saying was, oh, she was like dissing it like your bandana, like mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. But she was actually wearing her scarf. I do this too, right? Yeah, like where you're wearing the scarf and tying it in the back mm-hmm. and making like a bun in the back.
Yeah.
Right? That's a way to wear the hijab.
Okay. It's a Black way.
It's a Black way, it's an African way, and a lot of people now, even people who are not Black, are starting to wear it as fashion, right? As a different way to wear your hijab.
Right.
So this thing about clothing defining you, I mean, yeah, this is real, and it's a real conversation. So I had to stoop this out with my friend who is also Iraqi-American. Her name is Rola.
My name is Rola Araim, and I live in Atlanta, Georgia.
Everything is good. All right. Our levels are good. Let me see.
So I've known her since we were like 4. Mm-hmm. So I decided to call her up on Skype and ask her some things about this.
Okay.
Ready?
Yes, let's go.
So you wear your scarf nowadays like turban style.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty. Have people called you a hijabi?
I have not been called a hijabi, but I have been criticized that as a woman at my age should not be wearing a hijab that way.
Ooh.
But having said that, when I would go with my African-American friend, Muslims, that is not an issue. That is not discussed. In fact, we're just trying to figure out, well, how do you do it? And how do you put your turban on? And how do I put my turban on? So very inclusive. Whereas with the Arab community, they are discriminatory.
Mm. And so when elder Arabs who are not millennials start talking about Africans or African Americans, does it start to bother you? If it's discriminatory,
Because Islam doesn't talk about that. Islam says, in fact, the Quran, forget about just the hadith. The Quran says that no one is better than another. A person that can speak Arabic is not better than a person that can speak another language. And at the time it was the Persian. So why are we being discriminatory? Why are we thinking some people are better than others?
And there was this like feeling that sometimes like that the Black Muslims, you know, that they, you know, felt looked down upon by a lot of the immigrant Muslims that are coming from like, you know, the Middle East or South Asia, like the Pakistani Muslims, the Indian Muslims. Mm-hmm. I remember that really well. And I also remember on this side, kind of the feeling of the Arab side wanting always like to teach the Black Muslims. Oh, they're doing it wrong. Oh, they're, you know, they need to be doing this. This is not Islamic.
The scarf is not covered enough. The dress is not, is too tight. It's just things like that. And it's with anybody, what I had noticed is the Arab community would do it with anybody, and I hate to say it, with who have a shade darker. Mm-hmm. So if their skin color is darker, they'll keep asking more, and they'll keep teaching more and more.
Some of this is generational, right? It has a lot to do with when you came to this country, you know, all the judgment and the being judgy.
So you're surrounded by elder family members. You have many in this country. So I'm wondering, do you find yourself often having to correct people, like in conversations about Black people?
We will say things like, they will say the terms abid, and I would say sud, hada ismhum. They call them slaves, and I'm saying no. The politically correct is black in Arabic, which is sud. And they can't seem to, if they're not thinking about it, their go-to term is al-abid, slaves.
Still,
that's the go-to term. If they're not thinking, they have to be watching what they're saying. That's their go-to.
There's the word. We've heard this word before, abid.
Yeah,
we did. Slave.
We have. Sadly, we have.
Mm-hmm.
So that's Black Americans. What about like African Muslim people? Like, for example, me and my family, right? Like the Sudanese people, the Ghanaians, the Nigerians.
Because you guys are the only one that speaks Arabic. But then when you guys speak in Arabi, it's like, oh, no, you're different. Just like our friends when they're like, oh, all Muslims are. And I'm like, but I am. Oh, no, you're different.
Because you're talking American.
Yes, I can.
You have a dog.
And I have a dog.
You're white passing Arab. You know that, right?
I do.
What does your family think of me?
So you're different. We don't mean her.
Break.
Mm-hmm. This is something, basically, you're not one of them.
You're not like them.
You're not like them.
Yeah, you're different.
Rola's saying that her family and people think like, but you're not one of them. And this is so interesting to hear, because how often do we also hear, especially African-Americans, going to your little friend's house and someone saying, oh, you know, have Leela over. You know, Leela, you're not like the rest of them, you know?
So you've heard that before.
Oh, my gosh, yes. I've heard that before.
Mm-hmm.
You're different. You talk different. You act different. You live in a different neighborhood. You're not like the rest of them. And I cannot believe she's actually telling you that people are saying the same thing about you.
I knew she would give me the truth. Mm. She's my best friend, so she tells it like it is. She hates all of this, but
I just think it's so interesting that across cultures, like you're from Sudan, I'm from Las Vegas, African American, and it's the exact same experiences within our communities.
Right.
Right. And you have Rola, who's considered, she's Iraqi, so she's considered more on the white side.
Right.
Of being Muslim.
White passing Arab.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same, you know, with us, as like, you know, having these sort of white friends within your community, within, you know, your church or whatever, that you have this connection with, but you are obviously having a lot of disconnect.
Yeah. Like, you're safe to them. All right. So, but you know that concept that Rola was talking about in Islam, equality, that we're all equal in the eyes of God. Nobody is better than anybody else.
I don't know about all that.
Supposedly, mm-hmm. right? This is like the ideal rule. No room for racism or superiority. But there is all this racism, and it's very real. So this organization called Muslim Anti-Racism Collective, Muslim ARC, they did this study, and they found close to 2/3 of American Muslims say they do feel some kind of discrimination based on their ethnicity, where they're from. And this was in Muslim spaces.
I pledge.
I pledge.
I pledge.
I pledge.
I pledge.
I pledge to reflect.
Okay, so Muslim ARC does anti-racism workshops inside Muslim communities. This is a sacred pledge that they ask people to take. And the video shows people from different racial backgrounds. There's some white people, there's some black people, there's some like Middle Eastern looking people, and they're all taking this oath.
I pledge to keep my heart open.
I will develop a racial self-awareness.
I will check my own racial biases and internalized oppression.
I will be aware of overt and subtle forms of racism.
And people are not used to this. Growing up, I mean, we never heard of anything like this. Like,
you didn't pledge?
There was nothing. People were not talking about it at all. This work is all new. Muslim ARC launched in Black History Month of 2014.
Oh, my goodness.
With a hashtag.
Yeah.
If you remember it? Hashtag being Black and Muslim.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That one. They made it.
We're like the kind of sub-segment of Black Twitter that Black Twitter tends to ignore. now let me get it on both ends, right? My name is Marguerite Hill. I am the co-founding managing director of Muslim Anti-Racism Collaborative.
So that was the hashtag online.
Mm-hmm.
But what was going on, you know, on the ground? Were people resisting this message? What were you looking at? What were you seeing?
IRL?
IRL, what was going on?
Oh, you know they were resisting. Marguerite would go to mosques and Islamic organizations and hold these workshops and exercises. And there was one that was especially hard that she was having problems with.
Some people have a difficult time looking at their own privilege. And so sometimes, like, you'll get some pushback on our privilege exercise because we take it beyond black and white, but we may, depending on the context, they're like, but what does it mean if we had servants in our you know, original country? My family had servants, but everybody had servants in that country. And it's like, well, there's people, the servants didn't have servants, you know? So we're asking you to answer this question. You know, did you have some, you know? So it's like people will push back on questions because it may challenge how they may see themselves as a targeted group. And then when they're looked at, you know, when they have to kind of examine that. And then some people love it. They're like, wow, I never thought about this.
And, you know, slowly but surely, people started to get it. She would tell them,
you're going to actually come back feeling a little bit more human, and you may understand why the black women in your class were upset with you. And you could be like, I get it now.
Okay, so let's go back to Leah V for a moment.
With her.
I can't do it.
You did it.
Tongue pop. But first, real quick, let me show you another one of her Instagram videos. I am loving them. I'm a little obsessed. And in this one, she's like reading the hate comments she's getting, and she's all glammed up with amazing lipstick, sipping on a drink. It's so good.
Hired to be a 400-pound land whale wearing too much makeup. You're fat. Fix yourself. As the great Beyonce says, I woke up like this. This one's a mess. Hi. I'm not judging you or anything. I'm just wondering if you're wearing the hijab or not. Because sometimes you post stories without a scarf on your head, and I'm so confused. I'd kill myself if I looked like that. How's that healthy? That's obese, and she'll die of heart failure.
Let's get back to her story now.
All right, back to the story. So Leah takes some hijab breaks, but eventually wears it again, kind of on and off. She gets married at age 19 to what turns out to be a very controlling man. He didn't like the way she dressed. She wanted to start modeling. He doesn't want her to model. Then they divorce. She gets her degree in business and starts writing a lifestyle blog. Then slowly she starts to gain momentum. She starts to get more work. She starts to get more followers. She starts being asked to speak at events. Things are, you know, happening for her.
It's really interesting that the support that I've got as I was on the rise to where I am now is from the queer community. Just random artists,
old white women, like, they'd be like, yeah, Leah, fat, black, and Muslim, like, just Susan from fucking Ohio.
Okay, mm-hmm. You know, she's getting the support, but, yeah. You know, what about the Muslim response? Mm-hmm. Were people supporting her in that community?
Yeah, well.
And so now that I've got a lot more clout, now I see Muslim organizations coming to me. But before, they were, like, no, very anti-Leah V. And so I do see a little shift now about them coming to me now to do things. Yeah. And I get a little irritated, but I'm just like, there is a Muslim girl in the audience that needs to see me speak. So, like, I get over all of that. I humble myself. I'm like, somebody in this audience who is struggling with hijab like me needs to see me speak. And so now I'm just like, I'll come as long as you're paying. It's hard to be visible as a fat black Muslim. It's hard. For a long time, I lied to myself about who I was, who I should be. And, like, now I'm on the other side, and it's very freeing. And it feels really fucking good.
You know what? La-di-da-di.
Ooh!
Here you go.
La-di-da-di.
Here she goes.
La-di.
La-di.
You know what? Yo, peep this.
La-di-da-di. We like to party. We don't cause trouble. We don't bother nobody. We're just some men that's on the...
Ladies on the mic.
Okay, Hannah. I got it. You know?
So can I, after all this, can I please get back to my slick Rick, or am I going to get some judgment from you, Miss Day?
It is, apparently, the Muslim way.
Woke up around 10 o'clock in the morning. I gave myself a stretcher, a morning yawning. Went to the bathroom to wash up. Had some soap on my face and my hands.
And that's The Stoop. Our Stoop family includes editor Casey Miner, sound engineer James Rollins, music by Daoud Anthony, and episode art by Nima Iyer.
Support for The Stoop also comes from California Humanities, a nonprofit partner of the NEH. Find them at calhum.org. Special thanks to the NPR Story Lab. Our radio home is KLW San Francisco.
And then I got the files for my fingernails. Due to the night and on my behalf, I put the bubbles in the tub so I could have a bubble bath. Clean, dry was my body and hair. I threw on my brand new Gucci underwear. For all the girls I might take home, I got the Johnson's baby powder and the Polo cologne.